Let's proceed with WS versus Derek Kildrath. If counsel could please step forward. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon. Gerald J. Howarth, Howarth & Associates. I represent the school defendants, the Myron L. Powell Elementary School and the Lawrence Township School District.
Kevin Daniel, I don't know if you have a chance, but Sam, you represent the plaintiff.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Daniel Vanella, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of Amicus Attorney.
Good afternoon. Craig Hubert from the Schaeferman Law Firm, appearing as Amicus on behalf of the State Bar Association.
Marcy Hamilton on behalf of Child USA as Amicus in support of the plaintiff.
And Eric Kahn from Jaguar Morgaff on behalf of Amicus New Jersey Association for Justice.
And I'm going to call counsel in the order I have on this sheet that the court has. I'm assuming it was just politeness that led to the way you introduced yourselves. Mr. McCann, that means you're going to go first when we get there. Justice Solomon is participating in this. Please be aware he'll be watching the argument. Mr. Howarth.
Chief Justice, members of the court, if it pleases the court. Before we begin, Chief Justice, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
That's fine.
I represent the school defendants in this matter, the Myron L. Powell Elementary School and the Lawrence Township School District. This is a sexual abuse case. Very quickly, I'd like to review the facts with the court. At some point in the spring of 1997, plaintiff maintains that he was abused by a teacher at the Myron L. Powell Elementary School. Approximately 10 years later, plaintiff comes to court to file a motion for leave to file a late notice of claim. That motion is filed in Cumberland County. That motion was denied. This court has the opinion from Judge Geiger, and that's a very detailed opinion where the court explains in great detail how plaintiff failed to establish exceptional circumstances. At that time, back in 2017, because that motion was filed in January of 2017, that was the law in the state of New Jersey. Plaintiff was required to file a notice of claim within 90 days of accrual, and plaintiff was also required to file a lawsuit within 2 years of date of accrual. This plaintiff did neither one of those things. In fact, what happens next is also very interesting. Plaintiff essentially abandons the claim. Plaintiff does nothing in 2017. Plaintiff does nothing in 2018. Plaintiff does nothing in 2019. Then in 2020, plaintiff comes forward and files a complaint in a different county. Plaintiff files a complaint in Gloucester County. Thereafter, a motion is filed by the school defendants to dismiss for failing to comply with the Tort Claim Act. That motion was denied by the trial court. Motion for reconsideration was made, was also denied. It was the position of the school defendants at that time that plaintiff had failed to file a proper notice of claim under NJSA 59-8-8. Plaintiffs countered and said, based upon the new legislation that came down in 2019, specifically NJSA 59:8-3B, that plaintiff was no longer required to file a notice of claim under this statute. Plaintiff maintains that the statute should be applied retroactively. Defendants maintain it must be applied prospectively. That is the issue before this court today, is how that statute should be read. Very quickly, I'd like to examine the appellate holding in this case. The appellate division reviewed the statute in issue, and the appellate court did not specifically address the application of that particular statute. When that appellate division decision is read, it's very apparent that what happened was is that appellate court essentially focused on the Bill 477, which I will get to in a moment, and essentially engrafted the statute of limitations retroactivity application onto the notice of claim amendment. Essentially, that same thing was done with the trial court in the motion for summary judgment. In that particular case, the trial court really engrafted the amendment that dealt with tort claim immunity and used the language from that particular statute and grafted it upon the Tort Claim Act. What's critical in the analysis today, I suggest to this court, is what the intent of the legislature is. That is what we are here to determine. It is maintained by the school defendants that it was the intent of the legislature, the expressed intent, that NJSA 59:8-3B was to be applied prospectively. Critical in that analysis is to look at where that particular amendment came from. That particular amendment came from Bill 477, which was passed in also in 2019 and became effective December 1, 2019. And when we look at that piece of legislation, specifically Bill 477, I think it's critical to appreciate that that particular bill amended several different statutes. It amended the statute of limitations, it amended the CSAA, it amended the CIA, the Charitable Immunity Act. And it's very critical to understand that when that bill was enacted, the legislature went to great lengths to parse out what aspects of that particular bill was to be applied prospectively or retroactively. This is a critical component to appreciating what the legislative intent was back in 2019. When we look at, for example, the statute of limitations, or when we look at the changes in the CSAA, or when we look at the changes that are in the Charitable Immunity Act, the legislature specifically parsed out those aspects and specifically stated that they were to be applied retroactively. If we look at the legislation, and even if you look at the Senate Judiciary notes back at that time in 2019, when we're dealing with NJSA 59:8-3B, the word retroactive is never used. It is never used. In fact, if we look at Bill 477 and we count the number of times that the word retroactive appears in that piece of legislation, and again, NJSA 59:8-3B is a piece of that, 25 times the legislature uses the word retroactive. Not one time is that used to discuss the Tort Claim Act. It's the position of the defendants in this case that the legislature expressly wanted that particular elimination. And to be clear, and I don't think I've truly defined this to the court, NJSA 59:8-3B eliminates the need for sexual abuse victims to file a notice of claim. And that's why that particular issue, the way it's being asserted by plaintiff, is so important before this court today.
Is the retroactivity analysis that you're encouraging us to engage in essential to this case? Take a look at the essential construct of the appellate division decision, where you have a complaint filed in 2020. In 2020, the obligation to file a notice of claim no longer exists, and you have the statute of limitations having been extended well into the future for offenses committed prior to December 1st, 2019. Why shouldn't a claim that satisfies all of those elements survive?
Terrific question. And the answer to that question is that's not what the legislature intended. It's very clear that the legislature did not want to have Title 59 defendants to lose the protections that they had had for years. It's critical to understand that this court always sought to make sure that the protections that were given to Title 59 defendants, be it to administratively review claims and settle those claims that needed to be settled.
How can you say that, though, when they eliminated the 90-day for this specific class of cases, not across the board by any means, they eliminated the 90-day notice provision, which is exactly what serves those three judicial policies. Legislative policies. In other words, they've done away with the 90-day rule.
Correct.
So how can you say that defendants in this category of cases, the legislature didn't want them to lose something that they had under previous law?
Well, the simple answer to that is because they didn't say it. And I think that's very important to appreciate. When we look at Bill 477 and we look at all the different statutes that are involved, the legislature was very explicit on how to handle each piece of legislation. And when it comes to this particular piece, the word retroactivity never appears.
Just looking at the plain language of the statute, so 59.8-3B, you agree that it has provided since December 1st, 2019, the procedural requirements of this chapter shall not apply to an action at law for an injury resulting from the commission of sexual assault, any other crime of a sexual nature, a prohibited sexual act, or sexual abuse, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, yes.
So when was WS's action at law filed?
The action at law was filed in January of 2020.
So then it seems like pursuant to the plain language of the statute says that the procedural requirements shall not apply to WS's actions. Because we said as of December 1st, 2019, it says the procedural requirements of this chapter shall not apply to an action at law. And here the action at law was not filed until this was the law.
But what's critical to appreciate is that that procedural requirement only became effective December 1, 2019. So what does that mean? That means if your cause of action accrued after December 1, 2019, you no longer had to file a notice of claim. That's exactly what the two statutes mean when read together.
The statute doesn't say that it's about when the cause of action accrued. It just says the procedural requirements of this chapter shall not apply to an action at law.
But what 59.83-B is referring to is specifically to 59.8-8. That's exactly what it's referring to. It's talking about the date of accrual. And that's really what is key here. The date of accrual, as intended by the legislature, and as it was set up in this particular amendment, is that if you had a claim that accrued after December 1, 2019, you no longer had to follow those procedural requirements. That's exactly what is meant by the legislature. I think what's happening here, and we saw it in the appellate division, and we see it in some of the amicus briefs, is that there's this sense that just because we have this expansive statute of limitation, and we have this broad reading of the statute of limitation, that means that the legislature did not in any way, shape, or manner want to limit sexual abuse claims.
Would you be making the same argument if there hadn't been that January 2017 unsuccessful motion for leave to file a late notice of claim?
100%.
So you would say that even if the first contact between the plaintiff and the court was 6 months ago, that they still would have to have filed previously some notice of claim?
Absolutely. And I think what's critical to understand, this legislation, when you look at it in its entirety, and I think a very good piece to really look at, is when you look at the CSAA amendment that's part of Bill 477, that particular aspect, when it talks about, and with CSAA, you have two types of liability. You have active abuser and you have passive abuser. When you look at the amendment that took place in 2019, the amendment that deals with passive abuser liability clearly indicates that when it eliminated the term within the household, that by eliminating that term, it was only to be used on a prospective basis.
Counsel, could you focus on the language that Justice Winter-Apter read for you in 59.83? You read that in a limiting way and said that it was because of a reference to something else. What language in the statute itself can you point us to that suggests it has a limited meaning?
Judge, I think specifically if you look at 59.88 and 59.89, I don't have the statute specifically in front of me, but the requirement is that there must be a notice filed within 90 days of the date of accrual.
But that's not what 8.3, that language note does not appear in 8.3.
It does not, but that's, but if I may,
sure.
What you have, and I apologize, I did not mean to interrupt the court.
No,
I think when you're looking at 59.8-3B, what that is referring to is the procedural requirement under the Act, and that is a direct reference to 59:8-8 and those other aspects of the procedural requirements under the TCA to file a lawsuit. So I believe when we look at 59.83B, and 83B says that the procedural requirements are no longer needed, that's specifically what it's referring back to. And that specifically requires a procedural notice within 90 days of the date of accrual, and also that the complaint be filed within 2 years.
Is this only because you think that WS is seeking to hold defendants liable only as passive abusers? Is your whole argument based on the fact that he's only seeking to hold defendants liable as passive abusers?
No, it's as to all claims. It's not just as to the CSAA claim. But I will answer this question by saying that based upon this statute, this particular plaintiff cannot advance a CSAA claim for passive abuser. I think when you look at the statute and when you look at Bill 477 as it deals with passive abusers, it eliminates the term within the household on a prospective basis. What does that mean in the context of this case? When you eliminate within the household, you're talking about a school, because prior to that time, and this court is familiar with some of the appellate cases, whether they be JP versus Southern Regional, I think it's actually JP versus Smith, or when you look at DM versus Riverdale, those cases were clearly held where you could not have passive liability because a school was determined to be was determined not to be within the household. So when that term is dropped in this piece of legislation on a prospective basis, this is actually an argument that school defendants really want to emphasize here to the court. This is an example of how the legislature is limiting certain types of sexual abuse cases, even when it's turning around and saying we're going to extend the statute of limitations. So what do you have? You have a circumstance here where the legislature says we're going to let you go ahead in the statute of limitations and reach back for those people until they reach the age of 55 to file lawsuits. But you cannot do it against schools because we're not dropping within the household, which is the passive liability component of the CSAA, except on a prospective basis.
But so what about claims for negligent hiring, supervision, or retention? That's not the same as the passive liability, right?
They are not.
But so for those claims, for negligent hiring, supervision, or retention, do you still say that the language of 59.8-3 does not apply, even though it says the procedural requirements of this chapter shall not apply?
I think it's very clear when you read that statute, that amendment, it applies to all claims, including any claim under the CSAA or any other type of negligence claim, that for any claim that accrues after December 1, 2019, they no longer have to file a notice of claim. And that cannot be understated of the significance of that law. Because if we look at this case and we look at what happened to WS when WS was in the law division, WS, the complaint was dismissed because plaintiff was unable to establish extraordinary circumstances. What's critical in understanding what the legislature did is going forward, after December 1, 2019, if you're a plaintiff and you don't file a claim within 90 days, it's no longer a worry. You do not have to come back and meet the high standard of exceptional circumstances. And that's a critical difference. This court over the years has really cautioned lower courts when they review motions for leave to file a late notice of claim that it's important that trial courts look specifically at whether or not extraordinary circumstances have been met. Now, under the new legislation, that standard, that barrier for sexual abuse victims is gone. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's important to recognize that the way that school defendants are reading the statute, which we think is the intention of the legislature, is consistent with what the legislature was trying to do. If you look at the Senate judicial notes, they talk about they really want to have Title 59 defendants to be set up to be served just in the same way that a private defendant is, a private entity. And that's what this has done.
That make sense? Just looking at it,
sure,
the broad view, why would it make sense for the legislature to take away the procedural requirements that have existed for decades across the board under the Tort Claims Act, the 90 days that disposes of a lot of claims, and say that's all swept away for this particular group of plaintiffs? And yet, just by accident of timing, there will be a small number of plaintiffs who will be barred under the same 90-day provision that's now been eliminated for everybody else, just purely by accident of timing?
Well, if I may, Your Honor,
sure.
Let's look at what the appellate division has done. The appellate division has really said that if you didn't file your complaint after December 1, 2019, you're out. So when we're talking about setting lines and making determinations and what's fair and what's not, let's think about what the appellate division decision did. According to the appellate division decision, if a complaint is filed, let's say, November 30th, 2019, as opposed to December 1, 2019, that plaintiff doesn't get the benefit of what this appellate division, our appellate division, held in WS.
But isn't that just because the legislature said that the law would go into effect on December 1st, 2019?
Exactly. And what's important is when it was enacted in May of that year, it was given a prospective future date when it would provide its effect. And what's critical is I think this court has indicated, I believe it's Rothman versus Rothman, that if a piece of legislation is given a prospective effective date, that's an indicia of intent, that it wants to be prospective. And I think that's a critical point.
You flag this as a potential problem area. I'm wondering how many cases we would find where someone, knowing what the law was about to become on December 1st, filed their complaint the day before and risked not getting the benefits. Do you think there are a lot of those?
I cannot even begin to answer that question. You would hope that with counsel there would not be a problem. But the point I'm trying to make is there are lines that are drawn throughout this legislation. And if you want to pick it apart, you can always find somewhere where you think there's an inequity. For example, statute of limitations. Legislature has determined that for minors, they are allowed to file suit up to the age of 55, with the exception of the two-year window. Well, what about somebody who's older than that? Or the two-year window?
Why is it three? Statutes always have that kind of issue. But,
agreed.
But I'm asking a little bit of a different question. I'm asking why, given the clear legislative intent to revive claims that didn't exist before this statute, and by doing that in a bunch of different ways, but when it comes to the school defendants, really most critically, the statute of limitations, and extraordinarily critically, dispensing with a 90-day notice of claim requirement in one class of cases, leaving it otherwise intact, why would the legislature then want to say that for a brief period, relatively brief period of time, before the statute was enacted, a small group within that larger group are out of luck, having only to do with timing?
If I think I understand the question, I think what the legislature intended to do was they intended to make it easier for sexual abuse victims to prosecute cases. And what they did was they decided that they were going to pump the brakes when it came to Title 59 defendants. They made the determination that the protections that Title 59 defendants had for decades and which were recognized by this court were going to continue until December 1, 2019. And thereafter, beginning on that date, for any claim that accrued after that date, the need to file a notice of claim no longer existed. And I think it's really important to appreciate that, because you see throughout the legislation there's different line drawing on, but I think the most critical point that needs to be made about the legislation is when you look at the CSAA amendment that deals with passive liability, when we're talking about the elimination of the term within the household, which they specifically say is to be done on a prospective basis. So the question then becomes is, if they want to open the doors for sexual abuse victims and they have this expanded statute of limitations, why do they turn around in the same legislation and say, if you want to file a suit against a public school or any type of school, why then would they turn around and say for that particular claim, it only is for claims that accrue after December 1, 2019.
But it doesn't say, I mean, it doesn't say that. We've already been over that. It does not say, there's nowhere in Section there's nowhere in Section 3B that says it only accrues. And, you know, I'm trying to understand, you know, we've talked about the legislative intent to open up the ability to the sexual abuse victims to file suit, including victims that have potential claims against public entities. The legislative intent, the Office of, even the Office of Legislative Services report shows that there was an expectation that there would be an increase in costs because of this statute. It doesn't seem as though they, because of the amendments, it doesn't appear as though they expected the increase in costs to only happen with regard to claims that accrue after December 1. The expectation was this is going to happen because we're opening, because these amendments are opening up these claims to this statute to claims that were previously, you know, that needed to be revived because of the previous statute of limitations and even the 2-year window that revives claims that otherwise would have been out with regard to the statute of limitations, even with the amendment. So claims for individuals who are over the age of 55, they now have a 2-year window. In what scenario would anyone be able, in those situations, be able to file a claim against a public entity? Only if their claim accrued within 90 days of December 1st, 2019. So you have someone who's over the age of 55. Their claim is now revived because of the amendments. And their claim is revived because of the amendments, because of the 2-year window that allows for them to file a claim after 37 years. You understand? That person doesn't get to take advantage of the amendments because, oops, you're out. You never filed the 90-day notice of claims within the time that your claim accrued. That's your argument, right?
Well, my argument is not quite that alone, but that is a component of my argument. I think it's really critical to understand that what the legislature is saying is for those abuse victims whose cause of action accrued prior to December 1, 2019, they're required to follow the law. But going forward, the onerous requirements of filing a notice of claim, and we're really familiar with them. This court is very familiar with them, of showing exceptional circumstances. That component no longer applies for abuse victims. And I believe that was the purpose of the legislature. Because if the legislature really wanted to make it retroactive and say that it applies to claims that accrued prior to December 1, 2019, they could easily have said that. They did it with reference to the statute of limitations. They did that with reference to the CSAA claims. They did that with reference to the Charitable Immunity Act. In all of those instances, for all of those other amendments that are in Bill 477, the court went out of its way to use the word retroactivity, or they used other words. And let me just...
So, I'm sorry, go ahead. You were about to...
No, I'm good. I was going to search for something, and I can search for later.
Who is it? We see clearly in the charitable case, we see really all the private sector cases that potentially large numbers of claims that were gone are revived. Who is it in the public sector cases, the school cases, what category of plaintiffs who lost their claims because of the passage of time have those claims revived under this statute?
For school defendants?
For school defendants.
Okay. None of them are revived. None of them are revived because when we're talking, at least as to a CSAA claim, and this is a really critical point, when we're talking about a CSAA claim and we're talking about passive abuser liability, under Bill 477, the legislature's intention couldn't be clearer. What the legislature said was the term within the household is only dropped on a prospective basis.
But what about for the passive liability? What about for the, as I asked before, for when someone is alleging negligent supervision, negligent hiring, or negligent retention?
Well, that is very clear because the legislature told us something different. And you're referring to what was Bill 5392. And in that particular bill, I think the court went out of its way, if I could find this, it would be helpful, but the court used specific language that was retroactive in nature.
The legislature.
I'm sorry, forgive me. The legislature, that is correct. And I think that's the important distinction. When you're talking about those other causes of action, which are permitted based upon the amendment which changed the immunity for TCA defendants. For example, willful wanton, and you're also talking about negligent hiring, negligent retention, things of that nature. You know, those can be advanced, but specifically in Bill 5392, which changed the TCA immunities, it specifically uses retroactive language. If you look at it, it's almost exactly the same as the language that you see in the statute of limitations amendments that you see in Bill 477 as well. Again, they are specifically retroactive, and that is absent when we're talking about this notice of claim. Now, there's another component to my argument that I would like... Go ahead, I'm sorry. I don't mean to rattle on. I apologize.
No worries. Can you point to any other statute that uses the language at law to mean not an action that is filed, but instead when a cause of action accrues?
I cannot, but what I suggest is when that statute deals with procedural history, it's referring to NJSA 59-8-8, 8-3B and all the other procedural requirements which define accrual. And even though the statute does not specifically define accrual, we know that Beauchamp does, and we know what that meaning is.
Isn't that a vestige of the old statute of limitations language that's been around for decades? And back when there were, obviously, pre-1947, there was a distinction between actions and at law and inequity. I mean, those are old statutes. I'm just wondering if that at law is simply a vestige of that.
I don't have a good answer to that, to be candid with the court. I do not. But there's another important element to my argument that should not be forgotten here, and I'd like to advance that briefly with the court. If this court is to maintain or view the legislative intent to be retroactive, under Twiss, under Gibbons versus Gibbons, there's another analysis that this court must undertake. It's clear that even if this court is of the mindset that the legislature should have had or in fact intended a retroactive application of NJSA 59-8-3B, it cannot be applied on a retroactive basis if it's a manifest injustice. And candidly, there could never be a better example of a manifest injustice than applying this statute retroactively. Look at these school board defendants were certainly given the impression that as far back as 2017, when the motion to file a late notice of claim was denied, plaintiff thereafter in 2017, 2018, 2019, abandoned their claim.
But isn't this entire, I'm sorry, keep going.
No, you go ahead.
No, go ahead. Isn't this entire statute reviving claims that didn't exist before? I think you're about to say, and I interrupted you, that how unfair, they thought it was over, they thought the claim was dead, and now it seems to be alive again. So isn't that what the entire statute accomplishes on a much bigger scale?
I can see that argument being made, but when you're talking about a Title 59 defendant who has certain safeguards, and we're talking about being able to administratively review a claim and settle claims, being able to investigate and provide a defense, being able to ameliorate conditions if there's something going on, and the fourth being a circumstance where they're able to pay for or find a basis in order to satisfy monies to pay for defense and any kind of judgment. When you're talking about a Title 59 defendant who's had these protections for decades, that really becomes a manifest injustice.
But it's happening across the board.
Well,
under the statute.
What I'm suggesting is that it's not, because under the interpretation that I'm suggesting is that Title 59 defendants are being treated differently under Bill 477. And that's evidenced not only in the TCA notice provision, but also in the CCA passive liability, where they eliminate the word within the household on a prospective basis. And I think that again mirrors the intent. And because I think Title 59 defendants are treated differently, they are seen differently, that this becomes something of a manifest injustice given who they are and now how they have been perceived by not only the legislature, but by this court for decades.
Help us understand that argument in this context. We have as defendants the school district, and the elementary school, for example, they have an interest that is as strong as the state's, if not stronger, to protect children. When viewed in that light, doesn't it cut against the argument that the school district is suffering a manifest injustice if this case were to be allowed to proceed?
Insofar as having to pay for it, certainly. Because now you're talking about taxpayer dollars. You're talking about funds that are being diverted for another other reason than schooling children and taking care of children. School budgets have certain limits like every budget. If we're now going to take money and we're going to allocate these money to cases which the school defendants maintain were not recognized as being revived because they didn't file a notice of claim, we're now changing the allocation of taxpayer money. And respectfully, Chief Justice, I think that when we're looking at the role of schools, it's expansive. And educating children and taking care of children, all of those things go hand in hand, and they're very important. And we're also looking at independent groups throughout the state who don't have the financial resources to deal with claims that could be in the millions. Going back to what the I believe there was a report by the Assembly that Child USA makes reference to about it's expected that there's going to be more claims. Of course, because of the statute of limitation. Of course, the claims are going to cost more money. One of the critical pieces of this legislation that can't be overlooked is Bill 5392, which essentially takes away all of the Title 59 immunity defenses that were out there, whether it's 59210 or whatever the case may be. Of course, it's going to cost more money. But what these school defendants maintain is when it comes to the notice of claim, there's a pumping of the brakes. The legislature says we're going to continue to protect them to this level. And clearly, if they wanted to make it retroactive, if they wanted to have all these Title 59 defendants exposed, they could have said it. They didn't.
Mr. Howarth, in terms of manifest injustice to your client, shouldn't we factor in that, well, your client has had notice since 2017, I presume at that time the district or its counsel would have begun to look into what happened with this particular plaintiff. And they had a lead time for several years. And so even though they might not have anticipated what the appellate division would rule, you know, they've already had a form of notice for several years. Is that irrelevant to manifest injustice, or should we at least take that into account?
I don't think you can take it into account. And I'm going to suggest to you why. Because the perspective of the school defendants in 2017 was a plaintiff who did not file a motion for reconsideration, did not follow Judge Geiger's roadmap, did not file an appeal, essentially abandoned the case from 2017, 2018, and 2019. There was no reason for the school defendants to do any kind of investigation whatsoever. From the perspective of the school defendants, the case was over. It was absolutely over. And that's one of the reasons why I'm suggesting to this court, when you talk about a manifest injustice, you have a party that stands before this court who is under the complete belief that this claim was never going to resurface, that they never had to investigate it, that they never had to pay for it, that nothing in this claim was ever going to resurface again.
I thought it said in the briefing that your client wasn't even aware of this in 2017 and so didn't assume that the claim was dead forever, because your client only discovered it after the suit was filed in 2020 that there had previously been a request to file a late notice of claim.
That may be a better response to the earlier question.
Which is it factually, though? Did your client in 2017 know that there was a request to file a late notice of claim that was rejected, or did your client not know about that and only discovered it in 2020 after the suit was filed?
My understanding in the record, as I understand the record, because that was before the appellate division as well, that it was only discovered in 2020.
So then they could not have spent 2017, 2018, and 2019 being very happy that this claim was abandoned.
No, but if for example, an appeal had been filed under Rule 2:2-3 (a) paren three, which of course is permitted for a claimant who fails in their motion to file a late notice of claim, they would have been made aware of it. Instead, they were ultimately, and looking back now on the procedural history of this case, there was never a claim that was going to be pursued. And the reason why, very simply, is because this plaintiff couldn't meet extraordinary circumstances. And that's why this legislation has very important positive impacts on sexual abuse victims for claims that accrue after December 1, 2019. Because no plaintiff who has abuse going forward, who fails, if they had to file a notice of claim, they don't have to worry about extraordinary circumstances. And that is a high burden, a high bar to climb if you're a plaintiff who fails to meet a TCA notice obligation.
Mr. Howarth, I'm going to ask you to try to bring your argument to a close.
Okay, I'll do the best I can, and I thank the court for its time already. It's the position of the school defendants that if the legislature wanted this aspect of Bill 477 to be retroactive, it easily could have done so. It did so in dealing with the statute of limitations. It did so dealing with the CIA, the TCA, not as to 598-3B, but also as the CSAA. There is no express intent for the elimination of the notice of claim to be retroactive. It is completely absent. And the secondary argument is respectfully, there's a manifest injustice to the school defendants if this court applies the statute retroactively. I thank you for your time.
Counsel, let's talk a little bit with five attorneys on the side of the aisle. And looking at the clock, we're always very generous with time. I'm going to advise Amiki not to expect to be able to go for longer than 10 minutes and ask that you have that in mind as you approach. Mr. McCann.
Your Honor, thank you. Thank you, Justices. It's nice to be here, but because we've gone so far beyond the record, you asked if there's a manifest injustice. The school has been sued six prior times, and the teacher, same teacher, is in jail. So they are well aware of it. The cases have been pending since 2013. Five of them settled in 2015, and another one of them settled in 2019. So they're well aware of what's going on. And I think that you asked a question about did they say they were unaware. I think it's counsel that said he was unaware until he started getting some discovery from us that we had, in fact, filed this claim, the notice claim. So, and counsel says in his brief, plaintiff's treating that as a nullity. It is. There was nothing filed. There was no civil proceeding litigation in 2017. I filed a case where I had a person who I didn't meet until after the 90 days, who had been in psychiatric confinement twice, in jail once, and tried to commit suicide twice, and the court didn't deem that was serious enough to let it go forward, so he rejected it. I thought, you know, what else could I come up with that would satisfy the extraordinary circumstances other than what was in that complaint? But anyway, the law, we looked at this and it was discussed a number of times in the office. We felt we had until 2018 to file a claim if we wished to, but we're aware of the fact that the law was being changed. The current law that is here now, there was a different version of it proposed in 2018, which did not get passed, but I was aware of the fact they were working on intended to pass a new statute, so I waited to see what would happen. I felt that what said in the appellate division, by the appellate division, that a previously time-barred case was probably resuscitated by the change in the law. That case was filed in 2020, a month after the change in the law, maybe a month and a half, and it is entitled to all the benefits that went along with that. The legislature made a concerted effort to change the law, so it took care of people like W.S. T.S., his younger brother, was the first plaintiff. So all of that is in the record and is part of what's going on. And I was fascinated when I read all of the cases dealing with this, and you go to one case after another, where it says, well, if you can't figure out exactly what they're trying to do, you go to the legislative history. You would think with all of the lawyers in the legislature, they might get it right, but they have other things to do. They came out with an idea to to change these three laws at the same time to effect a change in the law so that the people who were hurt and who could not bring a claim were allowed to bring a claim. That's exactly what the statute was designed to do. Counsel for the defense would have you give us three categories of plaintiffs. Plaintiff set number one, and I stole this from the Attorney General's brief, is the people who did not have to file a tort claims status prior to 1972. Category number two is people from 1972 until 2019, who, according to counsel, even though they might not have filed the claim till now, because it accrued before they had to file a tort claims notice 10, 20, 30 years ago. It's sort of a result which I'm sure the legislature did not intend. And then there's the other category of plaintiffs who waited until 2019, until the law went into effect. Counsel keeps talking about accrual. Things all accrue all the time. But the trick in this case is the filing. The filing was done after the change in the law. The passive abuser law applies to the plaintiff and the school defendants. And counsel is then trying to argue that the law that was designed to do exactly this should not have done that. I will stop there, except I do want to say one thing to the court. I've seen the Attorney General's brief. And I think it goes, and I told Mr. Vidal this, it's not a surprise to him, I think it goes beyond the points on appeal in this case and asked almost for an advisory opinion with regard to what causes of action should continue to survive and what the burden of proof is. Is it mere negligence? Is it something else? I don't think that is before the court. I think what's before the court is what counsel raised, the tort claims notice, and the retroactivity. It certainly is retroactive, as found by the appellate division. Questions for me?
Completed your preliminary statement, Mr. McCann?
Yes.
Do you think this was an oversight, the lack of retroactivity language in that provision?
Yes.
Do you think they intended to make it across the board, retroactive, 100%, and then something in the drafting did not go right?
It makes no sense for them not to have wanted that and then to make the statute go back and allow plaintiffs to bring a claim for 37 years. Doesn't make any sense.
Let me just, we've had cases, the court has had cases since I've been on the court where it sure looks like a mistake, something. I can remember one in which there were three categories and they were here, they were there, and then there were just two categories in a statute. And yet we don't fix it for the legislature. We often flag it for the legislature. Why is this different?
Because you're trying to get to the legislative intent, and they amended three statutes dealing with the same issue in the same session. And it was obvious that what they were trying to accomplish is what I'm arguing to you should be accomplished. And in one particular part, they forgot to stick a word. They didn't put in prospective or retroactive. So it's up to the...
Generally, we look for retroactivity language.
Yeah, but so you look to what they're trying to accomplish, and it's pretty obvious what they're trying to accomplish. They're trying to accommodate the people who were shut out for years. We just filed a case last week where incident occurred in 1968. Not school defendants, but church. And it's that's exactly what they're trying to do, give people the opportunity to come in and be heard, as opposed to being you're shut out because you were embarrassed your entire life about what happened. I've been through 7 depositions or 20 depositions in these cases with 7 plaintiffs, and they're really embarrassing and grueling. Nobody wants to sit there and say what someone did to them. They've got to do it.
No, I understand. I understand, but you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
If it was an oversight, and if there, because I look at the statute, it would be very easy, and maybe they do that next week, to include retroactivity language right where it was put in terms of the structure of these other statutes added as well, without doing really any harm to what they were trying to do and actually promoting what they were trying to do. But if it was an oversight, what's the remedy?
Well, The oversight is this court looking at it and say, what was their intent? And it's obvious that their intent is to open up the ability for these plaintiffs to bring their claim and to say, listen, because yours accrued and then linked that with filed, you can't bring the claim because you didn't file a tort claims notice.
Mr. McKinn, I didn't read your argument, and correct me if I misread it, to focus on whether there was an oversight or not. I thought you were making a plain language argument that the notice requirement no longer applied after a certain date, and you filed your complaint afterward.
I did.
That suggests that you're in sync with the appellate division analysis.
No? I am, totally.
Other questions, anyone? Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I already did add what I wanted to about the issue with the advisory opinion.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Vanella.
May it please the court. The Attorney General has 3 points to make in this matter. First, removing the notice of claim requirement for claims of sexual abuse is retroactive. And the reason is, to the extent the text of the amended language is not clear on this point, it is the most sensible interpretation of the legislature's intent. The intent was to relax the statute of limitations for sexual abuse claims to allow 7 years after discovery or until the plaintiff turns age 55, whichever is later. It was also to make all defendants subject to the same initial footing when faced with a sexual abuse claim. That means that certain defenses that were afforded only to certain defendants by the Charitable Immunity Act and the Tort Claims Act have been removed. And that includes the notice of claim requirement. Our second point is that it is equally clear, if not more so, that the legislature's intent is that sexual abuse claims remain the only claims that are subject to the CSAA, as well as subject to removal of the notice of claim defense and other defenses that are available only to public entities or charitable institutions. A sexual abuse claim means the defendant must be either the active or passive abuser as defined in the CSAA, and an enumerated act is committed, and even then the defendant can only be liable for willful, wanton, or grossly negligent acts, or negligent hiring, supervision, or retention of an employee causing the act of sexual abuse. But plaintiffs in this case, as their July response to our amicus brief confirmed, are intentionally attempting to revive many more time-barred tort claims than those, which are based on liability theories that either fall short of or outside of the CSAA standards. Not only is that the exact opposite of what the legislature intended, it is also contradicting the prior holdings of this court and others. And to be clear, the appellate division did not hold otherwise. What it said is that a plaintiff alleging sexual abuse can proceed without filing a notice of claim. It just did not otherwise detail in the opinion what specifically sexual abuse means. And so for reasons detailed in our brief, our third point.
Can I stop you on your second point? What is your response to Mr. McCann's statement that that's not in the case? Is that because you're saying the appellate division didn't say yay or nay to that, in essence?
So what this court, we completely disagree respectfully with plaintiff's argument about that. What this court is going to need to do, whatever its holding is, it's going to have to craft a rule to guide the lower courts about what sort of claims, whether, you know, the notice of claim requirement remains subject to certain claims and whether it doesn't. You know, the plaintiffs have one position on that, which is the rule that the, what they say the appellate division adopted. The defendants have a different rule. We're just asking the court to craft a slightly different rule, but on the very same issue that both parties are here before the court about. I would also add that if plaintiffs felt this way, I did have a conversation with plaintiffs' counsel on Friday, but they also had the opportunity and did file a brief in response to our brief in July. They did not raise this point. In fact, the only thing they did was make argument why they disagreed with our position. They offered nothing further as to that when they were up before the court today. And I can answer questions on this if the court had any questions, but even if this were assumed to be a new issue, we believe there's ample reasons for the court to consider it. But
because they did respond to your argument, but you're saying they didn't say it was not appropriately in the case,
right,
at that time. Thank you.
Mr. Vanella, you've heard Mr. Howarth say that with respect to public entities, legislature, in his view, wanted to pump the brakes on liability. The Attorney General, of course, does represent state public entities. I take it the position that you've presented to us and you've argued is, despite the policy argument being made, that the state has evaluated the legislation and concluded, even for state entities, that the notice requirement does not prevent these claims that whether there was no notice before the adoption of the statute.
That's correct, Your Honor. As the more senior members of this court well know, I've argued in front of this court multiple times where I'm making the same policy arguments that defense counsel is making here, including the Jones versus Maurice Pierre case, which was another case that dealt with the notice of claim requirement. So this is a bit of a new ground for me. But the difference between those cases and this one is in those cases, there was only one statute with public policy implications that the court needed to consider. That was the Tort Claims Act. Here, there's more than one statute that the court needs to consider and weigh against each other and to try to reach an appropriate balance. And the Attorney General recognizes that. And so while there is a significant state interest in the increased exposure to state public entities, and as I mentioned in my brief, more than 100 lawsuits since 2019 filed against various state defendants alone that I'm aware of, we have to recognize that the legislature, I think as the members of this court have understand that they intended for that to be the case. Our position is they intended to be the case specifically for sexual abuse claims, which it defines very specifically in the CSAA, and which the legislature, by including the same language regarding the standard of liability under the CSAA in the Tort Claims Act with 59:2-1.3, what the legislature was saying there and made even clearer in their committee statements in the legislative history is that we will hold public entities and public employees to the same standards of liability that we are holding private defendants to. Public entities and employees would no longer have any additional defenses that only Title 59 gives them. They have any other defenses that any other defendant would have, but not the special ones. And they did the same thing when they revised the Charitable Immunity Act with regard to charitable institutions. And our position is the legislature have spoken. They obviously, as the court has mentioned, they recognize this will result in increased exposure. Wasn't clear how much exposure, but that was their intent. But their equally obvious intent was we're limiting it to claims where a public entity could be liable in the same way that a private defendant would. And so all we're saying is that that is not to allow simple negligence claims that, you know, the sky is the limit for the theories of liability that the state may face, not because their employees commit the act, but because the state always has some duty or another to protect the public. We just want the court to clarify, as it has done in the Hardwick case, as the Appellate Division in particular in the DM case did, clarify, we're talking about sex abuse CSAA claims only.
Thank you.
Anything else you'd like to present?
May I ask one? I'm of course. Sorry, Chief. Please. Does that have any impact on this case? I'm just trying to think this through, this distinction that you're drawing.
I would say yes. And to be clear, we're not asking the court to review the complaint and identify which causes of action may or may not be subject to dismissal, not because a notice of claim was filed, but the complaint includes several causes of action. We identify them in our brief. You know, you can make an argument for counts 2, 3, 6, 7, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13 that all appear to be variations of simple negligence, that the school district owed a duty to the child. Just a duty that any school district has. You know, they are in loco parentis. They do obviously have obligations, you know, which is much broader than protecting them from an act of sexual abuse. The concern that we have, and this case is an example of that, is if these theories are all allowed to go forward, the plaintiff may or may not be able to meet the standard under the CSAA. But why would they need to do so if they can hold the school liable for simple negligence?
Has this aspect of the argument you're presenting been fleshed out at the trial court level?
That I'm not aware of. Candidly, I don't know how far the litigation has gone. But if I understand what you're getting at, Your Honor, I certainly think it's something that the court could give directions for the trial court to consider on remand.
Thank you. All
we're asking is that the holding, if it does affirm in particular, that it just clarifies that one point.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Chief Justice, members of the court, the recognition of trauma and emotional toil and the emotional toll visited upon victims of sexual assault has resulted in monumental changes in New Jersey statutes, relaxing prior restrictions of substantive and procedural law. This was monumental and life-changing. The State Bar offers this amicus argument consistent with our organization's mission: promotion of equal access to the justice system for the public and fairness in its administration. To that end, we support retroactive application of the elimination of the procedural notice provisions of the Tort Claims Act, specifically 8.3b, as it applies to victims of sexual assault. Otherwise, disparate treatment is suffered by a class of sexual assault victims under this remedial statute. Now, while we've briefed three parts of an argument, I would submit, based upon what we've heard, I'm going to concentrate just on the first point, and I'll take a bit of a holistic look at the legislation, but the first point being the legislative intent as to 8.3b. So the court must divine and effectuate the legislature's intent, and to do so, the court will look beyond the language of the statute into areas of policy, into areas of legislative history, as well as reasonableness and common sense. The omission of retroactivity is incompatible with the legislative design and policy and common sense. As a whole, the law extends the statute of limitations for sexual assault victims retroactively, and it eliminates immunities under the Tort Claims Act also retroactively by clear language. It removes the liability restrictions, or some liability restrictions, of the Charitable Immunity Act retroactively. And it removes the tort claims notice requirements after December 1st, 2019, with no indication of prospective or retroactive application. So to interpret 8.3b as not retroactive conflicts with these substantive changes given retroactively by the legislature to the victims. For example, the elimination of immunities under the Tort Claims Act are specifically retroactive, and this produces a conflict. A victim cannot avail themselves of the retroactive removal of the Tort Claims Act immunities, the substantive legislation, unless they are procedurally in the box. Do we think that the legislature giveth with one hand and takes with the other? Not here. That is not the intent. That is not the result that this court should embrace. The intent is clear by affording retroactive application to these classes of sexual assault victims as it relates to wiping away certain immunities. But how can you reconcile that with not affording those same victims the ability to get into the box to raise those arguments? And what that supports is a clear legislative intent that the statute is retroactive. It's so clear that it's not so much an admission or an omission by the legislature, but it's just simply part and parcel of the legislation that they enacted. And the victims that are on the outside looking in are not only those victims that wish to avail themselves of the Tort Claims Act without the immunities no longer applying, but it also relates to the class of victims
where you have this revival, which is a substantial piece of legislation, again, monumental, a revival of the two-year period of the statute of limitations. Again, given retroactively by nature, because it's giving you this new revival period. So it does so, but it does not allow you access to it, as is conceded by counsel and was addressed by the court, but as is conceded that they do not have the ability to take advantage of that because they can't get into the box by filing that tort claims notice. It's an analogy as if the legislature gave a group of people dying of thirst a well of water, but no bucket with which to retrieve a drink. And the contrary position in this argument truly seeks to keep that bucket out of the hands of this entire class of victims. In part, the law reaches back well before 12-1-19 to accomplish its laudable objectives by relaxing the statute of limitations, removing immunity. But in this tort claims context, it gives no ability to take advantage of the extraordinary remedial relief unless we take the law at what is seemingly its face, and that the retroactivity of 8B3 is part and parcel of the legislation itself, because it cannot simply exist to protect victims unless it is going to reach back retroactively. This results in unequal justice and disparity in its administration. The legislature provided retroactive substantive statutory remedies to victims prior to 12-1-19, and this prospective application of notice requirements to acts committed on 12-1-19 or after leads to the unintended disparate results by way of exclusion that cannot be reconciled with the intent of the remedial statute. And Governor Murphy, as well as the Assembly Judiciary Committee, in their statements to Bill 477, are very clear. The governor spoke to leveling the playing field such that public entities should be held to the same standard of liability that is applied to religious and not-for-profit organizations. And applying a different standard would be unjustified. The governor spoke of leveling the playing field, and 8-3-B is that great leveler of the playing field to access these victims to justice. There, as I was listening to some of the court's questions, I'm not very good in math, but I tried to figure out a response to something that Justice Patterson asked in regard to application and manifest injustice. And I was thinking that if there was a 4- and 5-year-old child in a public school district in the same class and were abused by the same person and suffered the same types of abuse and perhaps even the same injuries, and it occurred... let's see, again, my math is not the best, and it occurred 20 years and 91 days in regard to the 5-year-old at the time of the enactment. That person is without a remedy, whereas the 4-year-old in the same class has a remedy.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Kahn.
May it please the court, given the position of my argument, I'm going to make three, I think, relatively brief comments just to buttress what's already been argued by prior counsel. I think Justice Patterson touched on this with questioning of Mr. Howarth. If we were to accept the defendant's position, I can't think of a case that would not be dismissed where the case accrued before December 1, 2019. And was time barred, both in terms of the 90-day notice of claim requirement, the 1-year requirement to file a motion, or the statute.
I can't think of one. So if a case accrued in 2017 or 2016 or before, the statute would have no effect. And I think someone maybe in colloquy suggested that may represent a small class of cases. It'll encompass almost the entirety of cases. I filed a lot of these cases, a lot of them against public entities. I can only think of one where my client is still a minor that would survive. Every other single case that accrued and was time barred before December 1, 2019 would be gone if the defense's position was accepted here. And I think that was part of what Your Honor was questioning Mr. Howarth about.
I just want to ask you, the word accrued does not appear in this line. There's different language that's used. When I first read it, I thought, well, that's accrued. It's about date of reasonable discovery. Just out of more curiosity than anything, because you're dealing with a lot of these cases, do you view that as just a fancy way of saying accrued?
No, I'm really actually responding to the defendant's argument in this case.
I understand this, but I'm asking a related. I just want to get your interpretation. Do you think that in what is now 14.2a, I guess, which is the new statute of limitations, that's just accrual?
I don't think it matters. I don't think it matters to cases that are filed after December 1, 2019. That was one of the points we're trying to make. I don't think accrual matters in the context of Your Honor's question.
But the language is not the normal accrual language. That's why.
If I file a case after December 1, look, if it hasn't accrued before December 1, 2019, doesn't matter. I filed the case, I'm within the statute or the tort claim. And if it did accrue before, I think the new statute, I don't think it makes a difference. They opened the window for a reason, number one.
The earlier reference that you were alluding to was whether counsel paying attention to the change in the statute would file on November 30th as opposed to waiting until December 1st, and I think that speaks for itself.
Oh, right, exactly. Why would you? I mean, we knew the statute was coming for six. We knew the statute was coming for a long time, we hope, but we knew it was coming for 6 months because it was passed in May. So certainly from that May to November 30 window, why would you, number one? And number two, if you had a case that was a close call on when it accrued, when your client knew or should have known that the cause of action arose, and it was 2018, early 2019, you might have taken an educated risk or guess to wait until the statute passed. And we've known that this statute has been around, the concept that a statute has been around for a long time.
You said you had two other points, please.
Quickly, so in terms of, if we're going to talk legal for a second, I was trying to take the practical approach on my first point. Legally, the defense is relying, when talking about retroactivity, really on express retroactivity. And what's not been touched on, and there's multiple cases that talk about it, there's an or, okay? Or you look at the legislative history, which has been talked about. Or there's something called implicit retroactivity. And implicit retroactivity talks about what makes the most sense to make the statute workable or to give it the most sensible interpretation. So if we're going to look at the last of the three prongs, the implicit retroactivity, what makes sense? Well, we can look at the legislative history, that's part of it. We can look at what makes sense, and it's been argued multiple times by prior counsel, what makes sense is that the intent here was to resuscitate claims, revive claims that were otherwise time barred.
If we look to retroactivity, how do you respond to counsel's manifest injustice argument?
Well, manifest injustice, look, there's nothing before the court that talks about school districts' budgets or allocation of resources or whether or not there's insurance. I just think it's, look, in general, I think it's an archaic, the statute's archaic in a sense. Back in the 70s, maybe there was more, this is really not an issue before this court, but public entities now all have insurance, except for maybe the state. They have insurance. So the fact we're not looking at, and there's no evidence before the court to talk about, is their budget an issue? Did they allocate for this? I don't buy that argument. And again, I think Judge Sabatino picked up on this. I represent victims now for years and years and years. The manifest injustice is to the victims of what occurred. And I can give a million examples where children were abused in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and it was covered up, or they were afraid to talk about it, or they told their parents who said, no, the priest wouldn't do that, your school teacher wouldn't do that. That's the manifest injustice. So when the legislature decided, after having this statute in the works for a number of years, to finally enact it, and the governor signed it, a small part of what those victims have suffered for the last 20, 30, 40 years. They're now allowed to speak their mind. And remember, most of them are older. Most of the clients I deal with are in their 50s and 60s. When they were 13 or 12 or 15 or in college years ago, they didn't have the voice or the confidence or the ability, you know, to tell what happened. But now they do. And when they had this window opened to finally have a say, to get some measure of justice, to now say to a class of them, a large class of them, well, this is not for you, that's manifest injustice, in my opinion.
So when you are talking about retroactivity, does that mean that you disagree with the appellate division that all you need is a prospective application of the plain language of 5983, which says the procedural requirements of this chapter shall not apply because this was filed after the language said this?
You know, I don't want to, I've had this discussion with some of my I'll call them co-counsel, the purpose of this. I talked about retroactivity. I think it's, if you file your lawsuit after December 1, 2019, in that two-year window, that's it. You're allowed to do it, as far as I'm concerned. I can argue the prospectivity versus retroactivity. I touched on it because I wanted to add one element to it that I didn't think was raised. I don't think it matters. If you file in that window, that's it. The legislature said you're allowed to do this for 2 years. That's as more of a plain language approach that I can take, aside from, you know, the legal requirements. And my last point very quickly was, and Justice Patterson also raised this, do I think it was an oversight or a mistake? I do, which is why I raised the implicit retroactivity argument. I do think it was oversight or mistake or just, you know, I don't think it was, and if you look at the legislative intent, but just in case, I wanted to raise the implicit retroactivity to give the court another basis to correct it now rather than ask the legislator to do it. Thank you.
But your primary argument, consistent with as Justice Wiener after mentioned, is that the appellate division is right, that plain language and whatever may have occurred with respect to the language of that one provision does not affect this case.
That's absolutely my position, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Kahn.
Thank you.
Ms. Hamilton, you've been very patient. Welcome.
So are you. May it please the court. My name is Marcy Hamilton. I'm here on behalf of Child USA. We're the leading organization globally on statutes of limitations, and I personally and Child USA was involved in getting this bill passed. So far, what I've heard is an argument by the defendant schools, and frankly, an argument by the Attorney General to try to redo the politics of this act. The package of acts that went into effect on December 1st, 2019 were intended, and this is over and over and over, and for the full 16 years that this act was being debated and drafted, was intended to revive the child sex abuse claims of every victim in the state of New Jersey, whether it was a public defendant or a private defendant. There is nothing in the legislative history or elsewhere that would show that the schools were given any kind of deference or intended to be special and not have to bear the burden of having their cover-ups disclosed and their victims met. The same is true with the Attorney General. The notion that a simple negligence was intended to be left out of this statute was never at a hearing I attended. That was not part of the legislative history. What the legislation gives us is, one, clear retroactivity, unquestionable retroactivity for statutes of limitations for every child sex abuse victim in this state. And secondly, procedures. And the procedure is that if you're in that two-year window, there is no notice of claim as part of the procedures that are required for you to recover.
Why is it only within the two? I'm confused about the two-year window. Well, I thought the two-year window only was if you already were older than 55 years old or your claim had accrued more than 7 years ago. But for everyone else who is less than 55 years old, there is no two-year window, right? It's all the way until you're 55 years old is when you can file the claim.
Well, the statute of limitations was so short beforehand that there were many who were under 55 who came into the window. And the prospective elimination, you know, or elimination up to age 55 was also a revival to age 55.
Understood.
Right.
So it's not a two-year window. For some people, it could be a 25-year window.
Oh, exactly.
They might have only been 30.
Exactly. No, the two-year window plus the other, the seven-year, which is also a revival discovery rule, and up to age 55, which is also a revival provision.
If a 30-year-old client comes into your office, they have well more than 2 years.
Yes. Yes. Right now. But I say all of that to just make one point. The argument that the notice of claim was unintentionally or intentionally left out as retroactive is an irrational argument. And I do not believe this court can adopt a reading of a statute that's irrational. It is irrational to think that school students were intended to be blocked from justice while everyone else was able to go in, the church victims, the sports victims. It's just, that is nowhere in the legislative history. And to try to read the statute so that there are these, you know, exceptions that help the schools or exceptions that help the state defendants, it's just not there. That is not what was intended. But let me just say this. No one has briefed retroactivity in this case. No one has briefed what torts are intended to be covered. And so if this court found it necessary to get to those two issues, which I don't think are necessary, but if you did, I would highly request, with great deference to the court, the opportunity to brief retroactivity. That's an issue that's running across the state. We're seeing it in case after case. And it would be unfortunate for this court to rule on retroactivity of any aspect of this statute without full briefing as needed for these cases.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Howarth, you get the last word.
Thank you.
I think you optimistically asked for 2 minutes.
I think I may need a smidge more, but let's see how we go. Thank you. Thank you, Chief Justice. I'd like to respond initially to the comments just made by Child USA, where the comment was that the argument that school defendants should be treated differently cannot be found anywhere in the statute. That's an inaccurate statement. In fact, all we need to do is look at the legislation as it deals with the CSAA and passive liability. It is 100% clear that school defendants are treated differently. If we look closely at that particular piece of aspect of Bill 477, the elimination of the term within the household for passive liability under CSAA is prospective only. All we need to look is at the Senate Judiciary Notes, look at the statute itself. It's clearly prospective. So the proposition to this court that school defendants should be treated differently, it's nowhere can be found, that's an inaccurate statement. They are clearly a separate class, as do we think are all Title 59 defendants and school defendants when it comes to the notice of claim.
So do you agree with the Attorney General's, I understand your initial position is that all of the claims are out here.
Correct.
But do you agree with the Attorney General's distinction among claims?
The position that I hold is that all claims, there must be a notice of claim filed for all claims that accrue after December 1, 2019. Now, Chief Justice asked me specifically, when we're talking about accrual, what am I referencing in the Tort Claim Act? And I'd like to address that very briefly. I'm specifically talking about 59:8-A under A and B. And when we're talking about the elimination of the procedural requirements, which is specifically discussed in NJSA 59:8-3B, it is referring specifically to this aspect of the statute. Again, 59:8-8, we're looking at A, capital A,
small a and b. That's specifically what we're talking about. So when we're talking about eliminating the procedural requirements, that's specifically what we're talking about. And that says a claimant failed to file the claim with the public entity within 90 days of accrual. It's a critical component to the argument by the school defendants, what the accrual date is, because when we're talking about this new statute, it's talking about taking away this procedural requirement. Simply stated, if your claim accrues after December 1, 2019, you don't have to file a notice of claim. If it accrues prior to, you're absolutely required to do it. Now, some discussion is as well, how do we know what cases are out there and what we don't? We'll never know that for a fact. We just simply won't. But the reality is that the legislation does treat school defendants differently and Title 59 defendants differently. For us not to recognize that when we just look at the CSA amendment alone, in the Senate Judiciary Statement, it says it's prospective. It clearly is for claims that occur after December 1, 2019. It's clear. I want to comment very briefly about manifest injustice. The appellate case, Serrano versus Gibson, is something that should not be overlooked here. In 94, there was a change in the TCA notice amendment law. At that point, you had to file a notice of claim against a municipal employee if you thought that they were negligent. The question before the court, actually it was just the appellate division, whether or not that change in the law, which changed the TCA notice requirement, should be applied on a prospective or retroactive application. And what the court really looked at, and of course that was from a claimant perspective, whether or not they had substantive rights that were going to be lost, because there were many claimants out there who were unaware of that the law was going to change, and to have a retroactive application would have been unfair to them. That really applies here. But it's just flipped. It's just flipped 100% in terms of Title 59 defendants. When we look at how that appellate court dealt with a TCA notice and said, hey, we have to be careful of the substantive rights of parties here, in that particular case, they said it would be a manifest injustice for us to have a retroactive application of a change in the TCA notice law.
Mr. Hammerth, I'm going to ask you to make very clipped arguments. We're beyond 5 minutes at this point.
Yes, Judge.
Try to wrap it up in the next 2 minutes, please.
Yes. I think the Attorney General's comment, I'd like to just briefly, if I could. Asking this court to weigh public policy, I think that, and I say this respectfully, because I think the determination on their position here was the Attorney General weighing public policy. I think this court's function, respectfully, is to look at the statute, what it's intended to do. I think the argument that it's implicit is a realization that it's not expressed, and it clearly is not expressed. I've heard two, if not three, arguments today that there was an oversight. Clearly, that takes it into a whole different realm. The reality here is the sensible interpretation of this statute is that it is to make it easier for sexual abuse claimants to come forward and to prosecute cases. By eliminating the tort notice, which can have some harsh consequences, as has been recognized by this court, by eliminating that for claims that accrue after December 1, 2019, is consistent with the overall goal of this legislation. I thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate Chief Justice letting me finish on that.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. Very helpful arguments. We will take the matter.